American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. For more information, go to queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Richard Marx sucks.
Sounds like a purse that was shaped like a vagina.
That's the greatest name ever.
Leo Jellison.
I'm Leo Jellison, bitch.
Welcome to another episode of American Timelines. I'm Amy.
And I'm Grover Cleveland Steamer.
Oh, back to that, huh?
Oh, yeah, it's back because Grover Cleveland Steamer is the greatest name of all time.
Okay. A lot of people. Some debate on that topic.
No, it's the coolest name because it's like Grover Cleveland from history, and then it's a Cleveland Steamer.
Right, we don't need to go into that.
It's just the coolest name. So I'm Grover Cleveland Steamer. You know what? Why play around with other names when you got it from the beginning?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people miss that.
Nobody missed that. Nobody said, came up to you and said they missed that.
I didn't say anybody came up to me.
Nobody's missing anything.
I've been getting a lot of...
No, you've been getting nothing.
Tweets.
You've been getting no tweets. You're sad about it.
I miss it. Don't you miss Grover Cleveland Steamer?
No, I don't.
My name is Grover Cleveland Steamer, y'all. Okay, my name's Joe.
Yes.
And I am Amy's husband.
And
we are a happily married couple who fall more in love with each other every single day.
Okay, so this is the podcast that brings you all the crazy, nostalgic events from pop culture history year by year.
Yeah.
And
neither one of us could find anybody else to do a podcast with, so we're forced to do it together.
No, that's not why. That's, you asshole.
Just kidding. No, we love each other, and we both like podcasts.
All right, we already went through this.
Amy likes true crime. I like everything else.
Everybody knows.
And so it's a struggle. And so what we do is Amy talks about a murder, and then I sprinkle in
what
was going on in the world.
Explaining the
time.
Podcast again.
Because you didn't explain it very good.
Oh, my God. All right.
Because maybe it's a new listener.
So tonight we are talking about 1976.
Yes, we're on to a new year.
Right.
The 70s were nuts.
So what's the first event?
So the first thing, I'll just, you know, as I like to ease into the new year, I like to tell you about some things that I tried and I failed. I couldn't find dates for.
Okay.
So it just gives you an ambiance of things.
All right. What is
of
it?
Of what's happening in 76.
Mm-hmm.
But first, we're going to start with the number one song where we left
off. Well, before we do that.
What?
You know the big thing about 1976.
Oh, yeah. It was the bicentennial.
That's right.
Oh,
that
yeah.
was the entire year was just, and I remember the, it's very faint memory, but I do remember like all the American flags, everything had American flags all over it.
You and I remember about 1976?
You were being born, coming out of your mom's...
Being born.
Coming out of your mom's twat.
Coming out of my mom's vagina.
All right, so...
I actually don't remember that, but my birthday was 4 days away, or 6 days away from the
bicentennial.
My mom always told me that it was... I was born on July 10th of 1976. She said on July
4th...
Great,
now people can get your personal information.
Oh, no, shit. Luckily, if they just look up Grover Cleveland Steamer, July 10th, 1976...
They'll know who it is.
I'm screwed. Here's the thing. My mom said while she was pregnant for me
mm-hmm.
on July 4th, that she thought she would get paid if she had a baby. Like, she thought I'd be famous, and then everyone would give her money for having a baby.
Why would she think that?
I don't know.
Did she know how many million people were probably born that day?
It was the 70s, and she was on a lot of weed, I guess.
It's something.
She just thought that she would get, like, local paper, and then they would pay her for interviews and stuff. And so she sprinted around the block, 10 months pregnant.
To try to have a baby?
She's sprinting around the block. She'd gotten a boxing match.
She did not. Now you're starting to make some stuff up.
She joined the Toledo Tough Man contest.
No, that didn't happen.
No, she did a lot of stuff. So this is the year I was born, but as you go into the year, as we left off at the end of 1975, the Staple Singers,
mm-hmm.
as we talked about, were the number one song. And I do have to say, I feel like we let down our fans.
Oh.
I did, specifically. I didn't look up like the last like 4 or 5 songs. I didn't even have any trivia about them. I usually like put a little bit of trivia. I didn't have anything about them.
Okay.
It'll help us get through the episode, but there's some big things. I looked up, and I'm sorry, but the Staple Singers, Let's Do It Again, we didn't even talk about this, was from a movie called Let's Do It Again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a movie starring Sidney Poitier.
Oh.
Bill Cosby, before he raped anyone.
You don't know that.
I hope he wasn't raping anyone back then.
I'm sure he was.
Before he found out he was raping everybody, I really wanted to go back and watch all the movies where he had those big sideburns and stuff.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Because he looked like a cool cat. Too bad he was raping everyone. But guess who else was in this movie with those two?
Who?
Jimmy Walker.
Oh, really?
Yep, Jimmy J.J. Walker played a boxer.
He didn't play that same character?
He probably yelled dynamite a bunch of times, but
he's one of those that I feel like that's the only character he could do.
Yeah. Yeah, he probably is just that. It was a comedy film directed and starring.
Oh, it was a
directed
comedy.
Directed by Sidney Poitier.
He totally was being Jimmy.
Yeah, Sidney Poitier and Bill Cosby and Jimmy Walker. It's about blue-collar workers who decide to rig a boxing match to raise money for their fraternal lodge.
Mm-hmm.
And so that song was in it in the beginning and the end. So let's do it again.
All right.
And I think Jimmy Walker plays the boxer, because if you look at the picture, it's it looks like him.
Man.
But now I bet you can't see that movie because Bill Cosby decided to rape everybody.
Yeah.
So
I know.
Sidney Poitier should be pissed.
I'm sure he is.
And so should Jimmy Walker. Do you think he drugged and raped Jimmy Walker?
I don't think Jimmy Walker was his type.
Maybe not. But anyway, that song was the number one song as we move into 76. Let's do it again.
All right, what's next?
And let's see other things that happened January 1st. 1976 would be the year the inkjet printer was invented.
Oh.
It was the year the word meme was first used.
I wonder when the first year somebody put their butt cheeks on the printer.
Well, that I'm sure that same year. I'm sure as soon as the inkjet printer came out, somebody printed their butt immediately.
Yeah.
76 was the year Andre the Giant set the world record for number of beers consumed in a single sitting by drinking 119 12-ounce beers in 6 hours.
Oh, my God.
That's roughly,
I think we did that in Chicago.
That's roughly 2 gallons of beer an hour.
Holy crap.
That's a lot of beers.
He was a big man, so I guess he could do
it.
He
was a giant man. And that, of course, it's not verified. I couldn't find the date because it was like, oh, Dusty Rhodes was there, but he was probably drunk too, baby.
Yeah.
Dusty Rhodes, baby. In 1976, doctors in L.A. went on a strike. That actually happened on the first. I'll just do that. A couple other things. The Trix Rabbit was finally, this was the first time the Trix Rabbit was allowed to eat Trix.
Oh,
and we covered.
I remember
this
covering the 1980s.
Yeah, we had the 1980 episode. So the 2 years are 1976 and 1980 were the 2 years that they did a vote. The kids could vote. And both times the kids said, yes, let them eat it. Because
fuck.
We're tired of it. Of him.
We're
not,
sick of the strife.
It's like torture. It's like abusing an animal. But
it was just the strife and the warfare of it all.
His first,
it was like a bloody battle to get those fucking tricks.
That Trix Rabbit's first taste it was a bowl that was partially consumed in 1976. He dressed up as a balloon seller.
Oh, so somebody had been eating it? So he didn't even get fresh tricks.
No, he started eating it, but then it got taken away from him. Because listen, the Trix Rabbit dressed up as a balloon seller to trade balloons to kids in exchange for a full bowl of Trix. As he gobbled up spoonfuls of raspberry red, lemony yellow, and orangey-orange flavors in excitement, the rope belt broke that tied him to the balloon stand. Tree branches overhead popped the balloons, and the rabbit landed on the ground in front of the kids. And then the kids said, silly rabbit, tricks are for kids. And they ran off with a cereal box. They didn't get any more.
Yeah, fucking kids.
Took a few bites. But, you know.
I wonder, I was trying to think, was Trix one of the ones that they had to take a color out because they found out it was like, had all those preservatives or toxins in it or whatever?
You know, that's a perfect segue. It's funny you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Because I was going to go on and say maybe these kids were screamed at by adults, like, don't you ever give your cereal to a rabbit, you motherfucker. You know, like, maybe that's why they were so. But it's funny you mentioned that the colors that had to go away, because red M&Ms went away in 1976.
Oh, they did?
Yep.
Oh, wow.
That's the year red M&Ms went away.
Well, there you go. That's what I was thinking of.
From 76 all the way to 86. That's 10 years without red M&Ms.
Yeah.
I remember, I didn't ever think there were red M&Ms.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Not ever seeing. So when they brought them in 86, I was like, holy shit, wow, my God, red M&Ms, that's great. I can't believe it. But I didn't know why they didn't have them. I didn't know they used to have them. But in the 1950s, several children became gravely ill after eating Halloween candy containing red number two. In the 1950s. But the dye was subsequently exonerated of any blame. But the FDA continued testing through the 60s, concluding each time that red number two had no significant influence on the formulation of tumors in lab animals. It was all, by all accounts, safe and acceptable. But then, in 1970, a group of Russian scientists ignited a red-tinted shitstorm.
What? Did you write that?
I don't remember where I got this from. It couldn't be on Wikipedia. I forgot to write down the...
I thought that was something you made up.
No, I think I got this from an article somewhere. But the Moscow Institute of Nutrition study fed male rats controlled doses of Amarath over a period of 33 months and found that 13 of 50 developed tumors. The following year, a second Russian study done with female rats resulted in a high percentage of stillbirths and deformities. Though American scientists immediately rejected the Russian study methodology, the FDA took serious action and ordered further investigation. Over the next 4 years, a series of equally flawed American tests ensued. Finally, in 1975, the FDA commissioned a definitive study to determine whether or not Red Number 2 had carcinogenic effects. What ensued was what one scientist called the lousiest experiment he had ever seen in his life. The scientist originally in charge of the experiment left the agency midway through. Handlers mixed up the rats, blurring the distinction between those given dye and those not, and most of the rats that died during the experiment were left to rot in their cages.
Oh, my God.
By all accounts, the evidence was inconclusive, if not an incoherent mess.
So they just decided to outlaw it just in case?
Yep. So then they said, oh, it has no apparent adverse effects, but then they contradicted it because a statistician from another government agency thought it did, and it just went back and forth. Yeah. No, it's safe. No, it's not safe. No, it's safe. No, it's not safe. And so they all just decided, let's just ban it altogether.
Okay.
So it's all speculation.
That's weird that was the story right after the one.
Yeah.
And then I mentioned
thought you
that.
Saw it.
I can't see from here.
It's a good segue.
Yeah. All right. What's next?
Anyway, so then Red went away, and that's all that matters.
Yep.
Oh, but you know what? You know what they replaced Red with?
What?
Orange.
Oh.
Orange apparently wasn't in there until then.
Oh, that would have been weird.
Yeah.
All right.
Do you remember being a kid? Do you ever see that commercial with M&Ms where kids were playing baseball, and if they ate a certain M&M, it would give them a certain base? Like,
are you sure that's not a game you played with your brothers?
No. Yellow, like green M&Ms gave you a home run. Yellow M&Ms were a triple.
Oh.
Orange, I think, were a double.
I don't remember that at all.
Maybe that
I think that was a dream.
Maybe
it's
just something
the dream you had.
Well, on January 1st, 1976, doctors in Los Angeles went on strike.
Oh.
And the mortality rate dropped 18%.
That's kind of shitty.
Isn't that weird? So it's like, oh, the doctors go away and nobody dies. Yeah, it's a lot.
That's weird. I wonder why that happened.
So there's been studies like, oh, there's all kinds of different times where doctors went on strike, and that happens every time. So
it does?
Led people to believe like, oh, geez, doctors are shitty. They're killing everybody. But if you dig a little bit into it, you'll see.
Is it that people wait to die until there's a doctor?
No, it's, well, a lot of it is that, you know, in the area, everyone moves to other hospitals and stuff, and the doctors are on strike, so then they go out to the.
Oh, then they
Los
go
Angeles,
to
go
another
to the suburbs.
Another city.
Also, people postpone their surgeries. And so if you think of all the people that die during surgery.
That's true.
Like, those surgeries weren't happening, so that changes the rate. Not that everybody dies during surgery, but you're. You know, a lot of people do.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, so it's kind of not as cut and dry as, oh, shit, doctors are terrible.
Yeah.
And then January 3rd, the Bay City Rollers. Take over the Billboard number one spot.
Oh, what song do they sing? Saturday night. Something about Saturday night.
S-A-T-U-R-D-A-Y. I can't stop this feeling.
Yeah.
That's not how it starts.
No. You're thinking of Uka Chaka.
Yeah, Uka Chaka. Uka. But you know how that goes, right?
Yeah.
So I don't need to play it, or should I? Anyway, I'm not even going to play it because I got to tell you about the Bay City Rollers. Like,
yeah.
I looked them up for some reason. I just wanted to see who they were, if anybody went on to anything else. And they all have had, like, curses. It's like they've all had horrible things happen to them.
Okay.
And I'll just go through each person in the Bay City Rollers and what happened to him. So that song was sung by Nobby Clark.
Okay.
Before the Bay City Rollers made it big, and then Nobby Clark left the band, and then they made it big. So that guy.
Oh, but he's a singer?
He was the singer of that, but then he left the band, and then they made it big, and then they toured without Nobby Clark doing it, I guess.
Okay.
So they had all kinds of problems from life-threatening illnesses to drug addiction and gay affairs.
Oh.
Eric Faulkner in 2015 almost died when he contracted viral encephalitis.
In 2015, though, right?
In 2015, so years later.
Yeah.
I guess if you have enough years, everybody's gonna have something.
Yeah.
But he just had a virus and he got post encephalitic syndrome.
Well, encephalitis is serious shit.
It's serious. It's like
your brain
or
swells
like,
and stuff.
Yeah, it's all swollen. His brain was swollen and everything just from an illness.
Yeah.
What's this guy's name? McCown. Les McCown.
Mm-hmm.
He battled his own illnesses, including alcohol and drug addiction, leading to a shocking confession on a TV show that briefly ended his marriage to his Japanese wife, Pico. He confessed to a string of gay affairs behind his wife's back. as well as a horrific date rape he endured when he was just 19.
He talked about that on a game show?
Yeah.
On a game
show? On a
show.
TV show.
I thought you said it was a game show.
No.
Can you imagine that? By the way, Richard, let me tell you about this time I was raped when I was a kid.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. I had some gay affairs with my Asian wife, and I was date raped.
And then I'll take $5,000 for... Potent potables.
It's always potent potables. Yeah. Alan Longmuir, whose brother Derek was also part of the original lineup of the band, he went on to a new career when they split up, training as a nurse and working at Edinburgh Royal Infirmary.
That's not very tragic.
But in 2000, he was sentenced to 300 hours of community service after admitting possessing child pornography.
Ooh. Him and who was the guy from The Who that...
There was a guy from The Who that watched child porn?
Yeah, the main guy. What's his name? I'm having a brain. What's the guy from The Who?
Roger Daltrey?
No, the main one.
Pete?
Yeah.
Pete
Moon?
No, Pete.
Pete.
The bearded guy.
Keith Moon?
Pete Townsend.
Pete Townsend, yeah.
What did he do?
Yeah, I think it was child porn.
Pete Townsend didn't do anything wrong.
I'm pretty sure.
Oh, no. Please tell me that didn't happen.
You better look it up so we can cut it out if not, because it's...
I'm looking him up right now.
It's a severe slander, if not true.
Yeah. Well, as I'm looking at this, I don't know if I got the right guy's name right who looked at child porn, but one of them...
You better have that part right.
Well, that Alan Longmuir guy died after contracting an illness while on holiday in Mexico. He got this horrible disease on vacation. He was 70.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know if I buy it that it's a curse, though, when it's happening and then they're in their 70s.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, whoops, it was Derek. Let me get this right. It was Derek Longmuir, who was the drummer of the band, the brother of Alan Longmuir. Alan Longmuir is the one who died. Derek Longmuir is the one who pled guilty and was the nurse. And he pled guilty to two charges of possessing indecent films, photos, videos, and computer images of children. His lawyer said he was not a pedophile, but storing the porn for a friend. That's according to TheGuardian.com.
Did you find anything about Pete Townsend?
Pete Townsend. Roger Daltrey thought he killed Pete Townsend in a fight.
God, who am I thinking of?
All right, what if I... Look up Pete Townsend
porn
controversy.
Pete Townsend and porn.
Pirate. Pinball wizard.
You're probably going to get a bunch of
Pete Townsend porn
wannabe.
Oh, yeah. 15 years ago, Pete Townsend arrested on child porn.
Yeah, see?
Charges.
Oh, I'm glad I'm right. Just because that would be a horrible thing to say if I wasn't.
Oh, 10 years ago, Pete Townsend cleared on child porn charges. Pete Townsend, I paid for child porn to prove British banks were... What?
He's trying
channeling a sex ring cash.
Oh, he's trying...
He claims he paid for child pornography to prove British banks were complicit in channeling profits from pedophile rings.
You're right.
That doesn't seem...
Yeah, right.
Oh, no. Yeah, I don't want to know any more about that.
Really? Look bad?
Yeah, well, there's different stories about, oh, should he be banned from playing places and whatever else? I did not know about Pete Townsend and that.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was Bay City Rollers.
S-A-T-Y-D-A-Y.
Child porn.
Okay.
All right.
What's next?
Saturday, January 10th, 1976. C.W. McCall.
Yeah.
Convoy.
God, that sounds familiar. I want to say it's like convoy or something like that. This is the song.
Arizona, noon on the 7th of June, when they highballed over the pass. Old Dog Mac with a can on back and a Jaguar hauling ass.
That's awful.
Dude just got a chair broken all over his back. Convoy is a 1975 novelty song.
It is.
Performed by C.W. McCall, a character co-created and voiced by Bill Fries, along with Chip Davis. That became a number one song on both the country and pop charts in the U.S. and was listed 98th among Rolling Stone magazine's 100 greatest country songs of all time.
Greatest?
Yeah. Well, it's country, so it's mostly terrible.
It's even for that, I think it would be awful.
Yeah, the song consists of three types of interspersed dialogue, a simulated CB conversation with CB slang, the narration of the story, and the chorus. It's about a fictional trucker rebellion that drives from the West Coast to the East Coast of the United States without stopping.
That is so dumb. Why would you make a song about that?
What they are protesting, other than the speed limit, is shown by lines such as, "We tore up all of our swindle sheets," CB slang for log sheets used to record driving hours. I'm not even going to the rest of this.
No.
Yeah, I don't. Novelty song. Convoy.
Yeah.
It looks like the video looks like it's a movie, though. Like, it's not a movie, I guess. That video was made for the.
So is it supposed to be like a spoof song?
It's a novelty song.
I know a novelty song, but does that mean that it's like a, like trying to be funny?
No, it's like an action movie. It's like an action.
Like, what is a novelty song?
You know, like that, remember that one that by the guy you loved that was singing about, he's at the gas station being silly with the guy that I thought was from Hee Haw.
Like Ray Stevens?
Ray Stevens, like that kind of stuff.
See, Ray Stevens is trying to be funny. That's what I'm wondering, is because does novelty songs mean funny?
Well, the song's running gag has Rubber Duck complaining about the smell of hogs that Pigpen is hauling. He repeatedly asks the offending driver to back off, slow down.
So it must be supposed to be funny.
By then, Pigpen has fallen so far back when Rubber Duck is in New Jersey, Pigpen has only reached Omaha. I think they were just trying to make a story out of it.
That's bizarre. 70s.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird stuff in the 70s.
All right, let's move
on. Keep in mind, everyone was on drugs.
That's what we said all through the 80s, too.
Yeah, that's true. And then Friday, January 16th, 1976. I really like this. Carol Burnett was dining at the Rive Gauche restaurant in Georgetown, Washington, D.C.
Is that how it's pronounced, do you think? You pretty sure?
Rive, at the Rive Gauche. R-I-V-E-G-A-U-C-H-E, Rive Gauche,
I don't know.
Rive Gauche.
I don't think it's Rive Gauche.
Rive Gauchy.
Yeah.
Rive Gauche. Maybe it's River, and I copied and pasted it wrong. Anyway, she was at a restaurant in Georgetown, D.C. Mm-hmm. She drank two or three glasses of wine, but she was not drunk. She exchanged parts of her dessert, a chocolate souffle, with diners at a couple of neighboring tables after they became curious about it. Later, as she was leaving the restaurant, she was introduced to Henry Kissinger, who was also dining in the restaurant.
Must be a swanky place.
Right? Yeah, of course. With rich people. So that is the event that happened.
Mm-hmm.
However, in March of that year, the National Enquirer published a short item about the incident. Headline, Carol Burnett and Henry K. in row, it read in its entirety.
In row, you mean? Like they're in a row? They're fighting?
R-O-W?
Yeah, that's a row.
That's a row, okay. Carol Burnett and Henry K. in row. It read in its entirety, in a Washington restaurant, a boisterous Carol Burnett had a loud argument with another diner, Henry Kissinger. Then she traipsed around the place, offering everyone a bite of her dessert. But Carol really raised eyebrows when she accidentally knocked a glass of wine over one diner and started giggling instead of apologizing. The guy wasn't amused and accidentally spilled a glass of water over Carol's dress.
So the Enquirer made it into that?
Yep.
Oh, my God.
And Carol Burnett, a passionate campaigner against alcoholism, sued the National Enquirer for libel persistently over several years, ultimately settling out of court for a reported $200,000. Though offering no witnesses to its defense, initially the Enquirer argued that it was exempt from liability on legal grounds, particularly on grounds arising from the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Initially, Burnett sought $10 million, but her attorney sued in California courts for $1.6 million, which a jury awarded Burnett in actual and punitive damages.
Good.
However, the presiding court cut the award in subsequent appeals. The award was reduced to $200,000. Though the final settlement was out of court, the case was widely regarded as a watershed event in tabloid journalism, and some analysts suggest it may have increased celebrities' willingness to sue tabloids for libel and dampened tabloids' recklessness in reporting, though others contend it did little to reduce a profitable industry's flouting of the laws against libel.
I always wondered that. Like, whenever tabloids put people...
They just say whatever, especially the Enquirer. Like,
how can they get away with it? I always wonder.
Yeah, I've always wondered. They say whatever they want. Like, so-and-so is an alien, has an alien love child, and they can just say whatever they want.
Now, some of them, like the blind items and stuff, I wonder, is some of that stuff, like, true?
Blind items.
Yeah, that's like, it's celebrity gossip is what it is. Mm-hmm. But it, but you know, there's a lot of crazy shit in Hollywood, and sometimes I wonder if it's, because there's been times, like the National Enquirer busted, what's his name? John,
about Gary Hart.
No, Gary Hart, but also the guy that ran by for VP with
Edwards. John Edwards. That was the Enquirer.
The Enquirer busted him, and so like you hear about them doing that, and you wonder like some of it true. Sorry, was that mine?
That was your phone. Make any sounds.
Is some of it true?
I'm a professional podcasting person.
All right. Anyway, do you know what I'm trying to say?
January 17th, 1976.
Just ignore me.
No, I don't know what you're talking about. January 17th, 1976, Barry Manilow takes over the number one spot.
I don't think you ever listened to me.
Well, we've been married for almost.
Like, I think I talk and you just keep rolling along.
Sometimes I don't know what to say.
All right.
So I just move on.
That's fair.
January 17th. Saturday, January 17th, 1976, Barry Manilow takes over the number one spot. Barry Manilow.
I write the songs that make the whole world sing. Is it?
Yep.
I write the songs of love and special things.
The Beastie Boys famously covered this lyric by saying, I write the songs that make the whole world suck.
That's not that clever.
You know, they're just talking about Barry Manilow sucking.
But they said the whole world sucks.
Well, he makes the song "The World Suck" by writing songs. Anyway, this is a popular song written by Bruce Johnston in 1975 and made famous by Barry Manilow.
Mm-hmm.
It won Grammy.
He's another one that was like a heartthrob to some women, and
was obviously gay.
Well, and who you never like? He's not attractive in the like we were talking about Rod Stewart.
Rod Stewart at least has more sex appeal than this.
Yeah,
than
Barry Manilow, there's none.
He's the nerdiest guy ever.
Yeah.
The original version of the song was recorded by Captain and Tennille,
mm-hmm.
You know. The captain wore that hat.
Yep.
David Cassidy did it. But Johnston, who wrote it, Bruce Johnston.
Yes.
He stated that for him that the I in the song is God. Like, not he didn't write the songs, but God wrote the songs. The songs come from the spirit of creativity in all of us. He said that the song is not about his Beach Boys bandmate Brian Wilson, but it's about God.
Not about his bandmate Brian Wilson. What are you talking about?
Some people thought it was about Brian Wilson, I guess.
Oh.
On his Wikipedia, and sometimes you need to copy and paste. I don't know. Barry Manilow.
That's a good cover.
Barry Manilow was initially reluctant to record the song, stating in his autobiography, Sweet Life. Mm-hmm. That's the name of his autobiography. The problem with the song was that if you didn't listen carefully to the lyric, you would think that the singer was singing about himself. It could be misinterpreted as a monumental ego trip.
Well, that's what it sounds like.
And so he didn't want to record it, but Clive Davis bugged him, and then he did it. It does sound like Barry Manilow thinks he's the shit. Oh, you write all the great songs, Barry Manilow? You're better than everybody?
Right.
Anything else about Barry Manilow?
Nope.
Song? Sunday, January 18th, 1976, the Steelers defeated the Cowboys by a score of 21-17 to win their second consecutive Super Bowl.
The Steelers, they're big winners all the time,
Steelers,
huh?
Yeah. This was when they started. They were huge in the 70s. So everybody... Everybody in the world when I was a kid was either a Cowboys fan
or a
Steelers fan because they just won all the time. They were the third team to win back-to-back Super Bowls. It was the first Super Bowl in which both participating teams had previously won a Super Bowl, as the Steelers were defending champions and the Cowboys had won Super Bowl VI. It was played at the Orange Bowl in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the first major national events of the bicentennial year. So there's American flags everywhere.
Yeah.
Both teams on.
That's right.
Both teams wore bicentennial logo patches.
Anything else of interest?
I'm trying to avoid the stuff that you don't care about the steel curtain defense and the running game. And
yeah, I don't want to know about any of that.
Care about the flex defense.
Any of that.
You know, all that stuff you don't care about at all. No. So you'll just scream at me if I talk about it. But trailing 10-7 in the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl, the Steelers rallied to score 14 unanswered points, including a 64-yard touchdown reception by wide receiver Lynn Swann, which you don't care about still, probably.
Nope.
But how about the Super Bowl MVP? You care about that?
Nope.
Lynn Swann. He's the first wide receiver to be the Super Bowl MVP.
It's a man named Lynn.
Lynn Swann, yeah. Cost of a Super Bowl ad in 76, you want to guess?
Oh, I can't remember what it was.
$110,000.
More in
is
the
all it cost.
Six figures.
Tom Sullivan sang the national anthem.
Who?
Tom Sullivan.
I don't know that person.
Well, that's because you're a racist towards blind singers.
Was he blind?
He was a blind singer and actor who was on Highway to Heaven. If you were a Highway to Heaven fan, you would have known who he was.
No, but I never watched that show. Yeah, not even once.
Yeah, Michael Landon was on that show.
He probably slipped women Mickeys, too.
I always try to imagine what that other guy on Highway to Heaven smelled like. He always looked like he smelled.
Think about all the male actors that are dead that got away with doing that.
Doing what?
Slipping women drinks, stuff in their drinks and stuff.
Michael Landon did that?
No, I'm just saying he probably.
Why?
Who knows?
Why would you think he did that? He's beautiful without. He doesn't have to.
Well, but there's so many of them that are coming out now.
You think
about
Michael
all
Landon?
The ones. Well, think about all the ones.
You're accusing Michael Landon of
I'm
rape.
I'm not accusing him. I'm just thinking. Think of all the ones that are dead now that we'll never know that were probably horrible like that.
Yeah, a lot of people are terrible.
Yeah.
There's a lot of guys who are terrible. The only. I'm not going to say it's a good. There's no good things out of this at all, but it's real easy to be looked at as a great guy.
Yeah.
All I got to do is not rape anyone, and everyone thinks I'm an awesome dude.
That's true.
Jeez.
It's a low bar.
Enough of the rapes.
Low bar.
God, why would you rape? What's the deal?
Yeah, I don't get it.
It's a mental illness, I think. Saturday, January 24th, 1976, Diana Ross takes over the number one spot in the Billboard charts, knocks Barry Manilow off, says, get out of here, Barry Manilow.
Is it Love Hangover?
No. Theme from Mahogany.
Oh, do you know where you're going to?
And do you like the things that Ready See You show when you? Where you going to? Do you know
that's a pretty
that
song.
We are down by law? Everywhere we go, every time
all
we
right.
do a show, everybody wants to know how we make them say, ho, ho. Okay, so there's a song by DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince where they introduce their
this
beatbox.
This is not about 1976.
I know, but they introduce their beatbox, Ready Rock C, and in the middle of it, Will Smith starts singing this song. Do you know where you're going to, and do you like the things that Ready C is showing you? And I did not know all this time that that was from anything else. I just thought that was a thing that Will Smith
said. Oh, my God.
And then so when I heard Diana Ross sing that, I was like, oh, she's singing the Ready Rock C song.
No.
Because
Jesus.
To me, that's what it is.
That's sad.
And if you look this up, it's called Rock the House. And
I'm not looking that up.
It's on DJ Jazz Jeff and Fresh Prince's album from the 80s, Rock the House. And the song's called Rock the House.
Nobody's going to look that up.
Ready Rock C. But this is where Ready Rock C, he's one of their human beatbox, their own beatbox guy. You know, everybody would do their own.
Nobody cares about Fresh Prince and Jazzy Jeff.
Yes, they do, because Ready Rock C did, he could sound like a beatbox underwater. And he went, and he did Sanford and Son underwater.
I know, you do that.
It was great. Anyway,
oh my God.
That's the best thing.
You
about
tell
this
that
song.
Story just so you could do that.
No, I mean it was the number one song in the Billboard charts. I had to cover it.
All right, what's next?
Do you know where you're going to? Do you like the things Ready See You showing you? There's probably some other things about Diana Ross about this song, but really, Ready Rock C is the only reason anybody should care about that song.
Okay.
I wonder what Ready Rock C is up to.
Stop it!
Don't you ever wonder
what's next?
Ready Rock C. Tuesday, January 27th of 1976, the number one show of that year of 1976. Do you want to know what the number one TV show was?
TV show?
Yeah, do you
sure.
want to guess?
Happy Days?
Yes! Oh, my God.
Oh, really?
I was going to say, on this episode, it was called Fonzie the Superstar. And with Potsy out of town, the band has no lead singer for the Saturday senior dance until Ralph informs Arnold that Fonzie could fill in.
Oh, so Fonzie got up there and sang?
Yeah, but when Fonzie finds out he was supposed to sing, he's not pleased, and he's worried that he's no Elvis. And Fonzie may actually not be good at something for once, so he's stressed about it.
Okay.
But Laverne and Shirley sing backup for Fonzie in his rendition of Heartbreak Hotel.
Oh.
But this kind of messes up the whole timeline thing because he dresses like Elvis, I think, like Elvis did in the 70s.
Oh, he does?
He wore like a jumpsuit, but this was in the 50s before he would have done that, so it doesn't make sense. But Laverne and Shirley were his backup singers.
That's a pretty stupid thing to mess up as the costumer.
I don't think they cared.
Yeah, I guess not. I just...
That same night, though, right after Happy Days, the number two show was on, but it actually premiered right after Happy Days.
Okay. You want me to guess that?
You
want to
guess what that is?
The number two show? Is it a sitcom?
Yep.
It's
a spinoff of Happy Days.
Laverne and Shirley.
Yep.
Oh.
Laverne and Shirley was on. The premiere of Laverne and Shirley was on that same night. It's a misadventures of two single women in the 50s and 60s. And the pilot episode, do you want to guess what happens in the pilot episode?
They get stuck in the Pepsi factory?
Nope.
What?
Laverne DeFazio and Shirley Feeney mingle at a dinner party that's being given by their boss's family.
Okay.
That's how you introduced
I don't remember
the world
that
to Laverne
episode.
And Shirley.
I used to love that show.
I did, too. I was attracted to both of them also, too.
You were?
Uh-huh.
Really?
I wanted a three-way with Laverne
and Shirley.
Yeah.
It's so funny because Laverne is the sexy one, and Shirley has no sex appeal at all.
Yeah, she does. She's the girl next door. Everybody likes the girl next door.
But Laverne, Penny Marshall is so unattractive. It's a funny, she was great, physical comedian. But
well, if you look at her now, she's not attractive.
No, but
if you look then, she was cute, kind of. She had a.
I don't think so.
She was cute.
She kind of had the Barbara Streisand thing going for her.
No.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't sing terrible songs. Anyway, I love Laverne and Shirley. I wanted to make out with both of them.
Okay.
I wanted to be Carmine. January 31st, 1976, the Ohio Players take over the number one spot.
Oh, Oh, of love,
roller coaster. Ooh, 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 roller coaster.
All right, that's a good song.
Yep. So, so there is an urban legend, a persistent urban legend about this song.
And you're gonna have to play this.
Yeah. No, I'm not gonna play it.
Not play this.
Or play
part.
That part.
Yeah.
All right, I'll play that part. This song has a persistent urban legend that during an instrumental portion of the song, a high-pitched scream is heard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's between 1 minute and 24 seconds and 1 minute and 28 seconds on the single version.
Okay.
Or between 2 minutes and 32 seconds and 2 minutes and 36 seconds on the album version. So the one I have, I think, is the album version because that's where I always hear it.
Okay.
This was Billy Beck doing that scream, but according to the most common legend, it's the voice of an individual being murdered live. While the tape was rolling.
That's such a dumb urban legend.
Now, why is that why is that funny when everything you talk about is murders and
no, but that's just such a dumb urban legend. Like, oh, they murdered her while they were in the recording studio recording the song?
The victim's identity varies greatly depending on the version. The supposed sources of the scream have included an individual who was killed at some prior time and her scream inexplicably recorded and looped into the track. Another version says that a girl has fallen off the roller coaster and was screaming to her death.
So they're recording on a roller coaster in that version?
I don't know. Another version tells of a rabbit being killed outside the studio whose scream was accidentally picked up by the band's recording equipment.
Jesus.
Highly implausible since professional recording studios are soundproof.
And usually in urban areas. Who's going to be skinning a rabbit outside?
The most widespread version of the myth, however, tells that Esther Corday...
Mm-hmm.
Who appeared nude on the Honey album cover, had been badly burned by the superheated honey used for the photo shoot, which occurred simultaneously with the recording session, and her agonized screams were inadvertently captured on tape.
Jeez. All right, play it. Let's hear it.
Casey Kasem reported the urban myth of the woman being killed in the studio.
He did.
Recording booth on his radio.
He reported
show.
Like yeah, that.
He reported it on American Top 40.
Like that was a fact.
The song was on the charts. Yep.
He did?
Yep.
What an idiot.
Here we go. Ready?
Yep.
Ow.
Yeah, I heard it. Yep.
Okay. That was it. That
That's was it. So dumb.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little creepy sounding if after hearing the Urban Legends, but that's the whole purpose of Urban Legends.
Well, and the band said that they never answered. Like, people would ask them, "Did you kill a girl in the studio?" And they said, "We can't talk about it." And we took a vow of silence. They didn't want to tell anybody because they would sell more records.
Everybody wanted to buy it.
Yep. So,
how crazy! What a dumb Urban Legend. Yeah. I can't believe Casey Kasem reported it like it was a fact.
Well, Casey Kasem's still tied up in somebody's basement, isn't he? Remember they were...
What?
Remember there was a big fight for his body? Like his... What? He was still alive, but...
No,
it
I don't
was like
remember
his
this.
Daughter and his granddaughter or daughter and somebody were fighting over him. Like, he's missing. Like, he was
what?
Like 92 and somebody was taking care of him. Then somebody else said, no, I'm taking care of him. And it was like they're fighting over being in his will or getting his...
I didn't hear anything about that.
Yeah, and he was missing for a while, and then he died.
Oh.
Yeah, you don't remember that?
No. When was that? A long time ago? Or?
No, like 2 years ago or something.
Oh.
Or,
if it was post-Trump, I don't know, because I
no,
disengaged.
No, it was before Trump.
I've disengaged from news.
It was before the whole Trump thing, but it wasn't too long ago.
Really?
And then Sunday, February 1st, 1976, was the first ever Black History Month.
Oh, my gosh.
Before 1976, it was called Negro History Week.
Oh, geez.
Which was created in 1926 with the hope that it would be eliminated once Black history would become fundamental to American history.
Which it still is yet to
So they expanded
happen.
It to a month in 1976.
Yeah, because Negro History Week, that's really, you know.
Still, it's the shortest month of the year.
A week. I know. It's
we
still.
We should have Black History Decade and just make everybody deal with it.
That's right. Deal with what happened.
And then have all women in charge. Black women should be in charge of it. Black lesbians should be in charge
of everything. That's right.
For 20 years. And then
see
we'll
how
check
it goes.
Back in.
We'll have Wanda and who's that?
P-Jax
that you work
I
with.
I could probably name 20.
Yeah, you probably
be
could.
Better at running everything.
Yep. All right. What's next?
Saturday, February 7th, 1976, Paul Simon takes over the number one spot on the Billboard charts.
Slip out the back, Jack.
50 ways to leave your
Make
lover.
A new
yep.
plan, Stan.
Don't need to be coy, Roy.
Just listen to me. That's a great song.
Don't need to discuss much. Did you know that backing vocals on the single were performed by Patty Austin, Valerie Simpson, and Phoebe Snow?
No. I don't know those people.
You don't know who they are?
No.
This was written after Simon's divorce from his first wife, Peggy Harper.
Oh.
The song is a mistress's humorous advice to a husband on ways to end a relationship.
Yeah.
It was recorded in a small New York City studio on Broadway.
It's a great song. I love that song.
It is a good song.
I love Paul Simon's music, both with Garfunkel and Post. I think his stuff is so awesome.
Would you ever think of Garfunkel when you make love to me? Would you ever make love to me and think of Garfunkel?
Well, no. You kind of look like Garfunkel down in the nether regions, if you know what I'm saying.
Whoa! That's a merkin. That's a merkin that I wear. A Garfunkel merkin that I got. It's an official Garfunkel merkin. And now everyone knows about it. You have to share my... Garfunkel merkin.
Everybody's going to have to look up what a merkin is.
Everybody's going to be Googling merkin, y'all. Oh, I thought everybody knew what that was, but I found out recently.
Nope.
And people still don't know
theater.
What a merkin is.
I think it's a theater thing.
Sunday, February 8th, 1976, one of the Best Picture nominees came out.
Yes.
Taxi Driver.
Yes.
With Jodie Foster and Harvey Keitel.
And Robert De Niro.
Starring Robert De Niro. Did you know that Robert De Niro worked 15 hours a day for a month driving cabs as prep for his role?
Did he?
He also studied mental illness, and during his off time when filming, he visited a U.S. Army base in northern Italy, and tape recorded conversations with Midwestern soldiers so that he could pick up their accent.
Oh, he's such a method actor, him and Al Pacino.
And between the time that De Niro signed a $35,000 contract to appear in this film and when it began filming, he won an Oscar for his role in Godfather Part II, and his profile soared.
Oh, man.
The producers were terrified that De Niro would ask for a,
a raise, a
large pay raise.
Yeah.
And they were some of the Columbia Pictures people were looking for excuses to pull the plug, so they were kind of hoping he would. But he said, "Nope, I'm going to honor my original deal so the film could get made." Jodie Foster claimed that Robert De Niro would regularly call her up and suggest they have coffee together and then rehearse the diner scene over and over to the point where Foster got bored, but still De Niro would insist that they continue rehearsing. Wouldn't that drive you
nuts?
Oh,
God. I've worked with people like that.
Yeah, they just keep wanting to go over. It's like, we got it down, jackass.
Well, and it's so tiring to do it over and over and over.
It loses its luster.
Yeah.
Well, here's a weird thing. Jodie Foster was 12 years old when the movie was filmed, so she couldn't do the more explicit scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Her character was also 12 years old. Connie Foster, Jodie's older sister, who was 19 when the film was produced, was cast as her body double for those scenes. I don't remember any sexual scenes with her, but I saw this a long time ago when I was in college. And
I've never seen it.
I probably was high on the weed.
Yeah.
And then one other thing, the scene where Travis Bickle is talking to himself in the mirror, is kind of the famous scene where he's like, you talking to me?
Yeah.
Completely ad-libbed.
Really?
By Robert De Niro. Yep. The stage direction just said, talk to yourself in the mirror.
Oh, sweet.
How cool is that?
Yeah.
Robert De Niro's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's a good actor.
I guess.
I wonder if he's a nice guy.
I don't know, but, you know, he hates Trump, right?
Oh, he does?
And he got one of the bombs when that crazy Trump supporter sent the bombs to all the liberal people. He got one.
Oh, he did?
He was just, apparently he was just on Saturday Night Live. I didn't watch this, but he was playing Bob Mueller. And they did a skit in the opening scene with Eric Trump and Donald Trump Jr.
Yeah.
Bad, and Mueller comes in or something. I got to watch it. But
oh, funny.
That's got to be funny.
Yeah.
Anyway. That's Taxi Driver. It was great. I remember being a great movie. It's supposed to be one of the movies in American history that you have to see.
Like, yeah.
Just one of the best. But it was not one of the top five grossing at all that year. I don't think it was real popular that year. But it was up for Best Picture, but it did not win.
Okay.
We will reveal who won later. Tuesday, February 10th, the very next day, Sesame Street aired an episode, number 847, featuring Margaret Hamilton. You know who that is?
Margaret Hamilton.
Does it sound familiar?
Yeah, she was. Was she the Wicked Witch of the West?
Yes. So
yeah.
She was reprising her role as the Wicked Witch from the film The Wizard of Oz, but it scared children so badly that the episode has never been re-aired.
Wow.
They got all kinds of complaints of kids being scared and freaked out by her.
But
the Wicked Witch.
And if you've ever seen The Wizard of Oz, it's like one of those movies where everybody who saw it as a kid has a different part that freaked them out really bad. Like my part is when they go in to see the wizard and that big
flying monkeys.
No, the big head that comes up in the flames and is talking to him.
That's supposed to be Oz, right?
He's supposed to be Oz, yeah. And my mom's part is the part where the legs curl up under the house. And, like, everybody's got a different part. Like, you said the flying monkeys freaked you out.
No, I don't think. I never saw it when I was a kid.
Oh, you didn't?
I never. I always thought it was, like, a girl show. I didn't care about it. But something I just discovered that I wish I would have talked about in the 90s episodes. I'm going through. I have the WWE Network.
Yes.
Because I stopped watching wrestling when I got to
now, life. Well, how is this wrestling?
I'll tell you. Just a minute. I'll tell you.
You're.
Okay. So I'm watching all the wrestling that I missed after I stopped watching wrestling. I'm curious as to what happened. Like, how did it get to where they are now from the guys I liked? I just stopped watching it, and I don't know what happened. So,
all right.
And then in college, I watched it a little bit. Like, a bunch of guys got together and watched pay-per-views because the NWO came out. We thought those guys were cool, but I didn't know where those guys came from. I'm in 1991 right now, reliving all this stuff, and they introduced possibly the stupidest wrestling gimmick of all time.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, it gets dark, and the Wizard of Oz people show up. Dorothy and a lion and a scarecrow and Tin Man or whatever. And they come down to the ring, and they're like, oh, my God, what's happening? And I was like, oh, no, what's going on? Why is Dorothy here? What's going on?
Oh, my God, that is so stupid.
They go back up the entrance, and then this old wizard comes out, and there's like a castle background, and it's all dark, and then all of a sudden Oz shows up. And it's this big head, and it's the smoke, and it's this guy wearing a mask that looks like a wizard. Like, he's wearing like a Halloween mask. This big, tall guy, he's 8 feet tall
or 7 feet tall,
comes walking down to the ring, and then he takes the mask off, and it's Kevin Nash, who ends up being one of the NWO guys later. But he wrestles for a couple months as Oz. Like, he's just
what?
Oz. So every time he comes out to the ring, they recreate that whole thing. Like, a wizard comes out with him, and he turns around, and he's wearing this
mask. That is so stupid.
Mask. And then he takes off the mask, and he wrestles as a guy. It's the dumbest thing I've ever seen.
Honey, I had no idea wrestling that happened. Is the dumbest thing I've ever seen.
Oh, it's so dumb. Like, just when he thought it couldn't be any dumber. Like, the
so
dumbest
that's
thing
that's my question always with that.
Yeah, so Kevin Nash was Oz. That's the stupidest thing ever. So if you didn't know that, go back and look. It was like maybe February or March of 91.
God.
Look for Oz. I didn't know that happened.
All right.
Anyway, and then Thursday, February 12th, 1976, there was a violent movie star death.
Oh.
Someone who was Sal Mineo.
Yeah.
Was arriving home after rehearsal on February 12th, 1976. Was it Mineo? Sal Mineo?
Mineo.
Sal Mineo. He was arriving home after rehearsal on February 12th when he was stabbed to death in the alley behind his apartment building near the Sunset Strip in West Hollywood, California. He was stabbed just once, but the knife blade struck his heart, leading to immediate and fatal internal bleeding.
Wow. So it was quick. He didn't know what hit him.
Yep. In March of 1979, pizza delivery man Lionel Ray Williams was sentenced to 57 years in prison for killing him and for 10 robberies in the same area. Although considerable confusion existed as to what witnesses had seen in the darkness the night he was murdered, Williams claimed to have had no idea who Mineo was. Corrections officers later said they had overheard Williams admitting to the stabbing. Williams was defended by jazz bassist and lawyer Mort Herbert.
Oh.
That's a weird thing.
That is weird.
So Sal Mineo has his breakthrough as an actor in 1955 in Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah,
did
that's
you know
right.
That? Yes, yeah. What he was. By the early 60s, he was becoming too old to play the type of role that had made him famous, and his rumored homosexuality led to his being considered inappropriate for leading roles. He said, "One minute, it seemed I had more movie offers than I could handle. The next, nobody wanted me."
That's how it always is, I think.
Yeah. But then he made but by 1976, his career had started to turn around while he played a role of a bisexual burglar in a series of stage performances of the comedy P.S. Your Cat is Dead in San Francisco.
Okay.
You ever heard of that?
No.
That's supposed to be funny.
Okay.
Or supposed to be good or something. I don't know. Anyway, and then he got murdered by a pizza guy.
That's sad.
Yeah, it is sad. Anytime anybody gets murdered by a pizza guy, it's a sad
state of affairs.
Situation. And then Saturday, all the way to the end of February 28th.
If you think about it, all pizza guys are slowly murdering us. You know?
I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially if you get that Papa John's pizza that just uses ranch sauce as the sauce.
That's right.
That's murdering us.
Slowly murdering us.
It's definitely murdering my bowels.
That's right. Okay.
February 28th. Rhythm Heritage takes over the number one spot in the Billboard charts.
What?
You know what song Rhythm Heritage comes out with?
I know.
Do you want to know?
Yeah.
The theme. It's a theme song.
SWAT?
The theme from SWAT.
Oh, my God.
Yep. In 1987, LL Cool J sampled the song for a single I'm Bad, which is probably one of the greatest rap songs of all time. No
Sweet.
Rap can rap quite
All
like
right.
I can. I'm talking muscle bound man and put his face in the sand. Sorry, that's a great song.
Okay.
That was on Bigger and Deafer.
Yes.
And then they redid SWAT on a film with Samuel
That's
L.
the
Jackson,
weird thing in the 70s of putting TV theme songs as the top Billboard hits.
Yeah, people love theme songs.
It's so funny that.
Well, they were pretty good, though. This was a good song. It was kind of like a disco song.
Yeah,
this disco.
One's. But there's. It's so funny, though, because.
Making your way in the world.
And then,
world
like, words
today.
Like. The songs like Rubber Ducky was one, and.
Rubber Ducky.
It's just bizarre.
One.
It's a top Billboard
you
hit.
Make bad time lots of fun. That's a great song.
That'd be
though.
A good one to redo.
That would be.
For somebody
in
to
a
redo.
Rap style.
I don't know about that.
Hip hop. We should have. You know, Migos do it.
Who?
Migos.
What are you talking about?
You know,
about?
Migos. Offset is a guy.
No.
In Migos.
No.
Cardi B. You know Cardi B?
No.
Cardi B put a pussy on Offset.
All right.
Sorry.
Are you having a stroke?
No, Cardi B.
You don't even make sense right now.
I know. I didn't think I made sense either, but Cardi B is a rapper. Mm-hmm. She's a lady rapper.
Yeah.
And she keeps talking about putting her pussy on Offset.
What is that supposed to mean?
I put my pussy on Offset. I don't know. I was like, what is this? And I felt so old and white. I'm like, man, I don't know what these millennials are talking about. They're putting their pussy on Offset. I don't know what that means.
You've never looked it up?
So I finally figured out Offset is a guy. He's a dude in a rap group called Migos.
God, why are we talking about this
right
now?
Put her pussy on a guy. So that makes sense. That's what Offset
doesn't make sense.
I just wanted to know what putting your pussy on Offset meant, and now I know.
All right.
Oh, it's about redoing songs. I don't know how we got to that. What are we?
I don't know.
Offset? I don't know. It's a person. Anyway, Offset is a person.
Okay.
It was like a Rosebud is a sled type moment I had. I was like, oh, Offset is a person. She's putting her pussy on a person.
All right. Glad we cleared that up.
Saturday, February 20th, that same day that SWAT became the number one song, mm-hmm. while accepting the Grammy for Album of the Year, Paul Simon thanked Stevie Wonder for not releasing an album that year.
Oh.
And I think we talked about this before.
Cha-ching.
Because Stevie Wonder won the award in 74 and 75. Yeah. And then he won it again in 77. So, like, the only year he didn't.
It was Paul Simon.
Paul Simon, because Stevie Wonder didn't put out one.
So, Wilma Swain was on duty in the Lookout Tower, 5 miles south of Columbia, South Carolina, on Tuesday, March 2nd, 1976.
Oh, the same day that Arnold got married on Happy Days.
Yes.
Arnold got married, and Fonzie was the best man, but... he's upset that the Fonzie curse is going to ruin his wedding. And also, Policewoman, starring Angie Dickinson, was on.
Oh, right. So she noticed smoke rising from a wooded area only a mile from the tower's base beside the Highway 94.
Okay.
She radioed Ronald Brickhouse.
He's a brick house.
A North Carolina Forestry Service ranger who investigated the fire around 1 p.m.
This guy, I don't know this guy, but he sounds badass.
Yeah. The fire had spread over about 3 acres of brush and pine plantings when he arrived.
Uh-oh.
He'd been fighting the blaze about 10 minutes when he decided to return to his truck and radio for help.
This dude had a big mustache. You know it.
Yeah.
Big, giant dude.
Yep. What he discovered next changed his life forever and began a mystery that remains unsolved to this day.
Oh. Oh, my God. What did he discover?
This is what he says. On the way back out by the fire, I saw a pile of dirt and walked over, and there were two bodies lying in the hole.
Oh.
He radioed Swain to send the sheriff, but he did not tell her what he had found. I thought maybe it was a whiskey still he had run up on, she said. It wasn't.
Uh-oh.
He found a gasoline can still burning nearby and concluded the fire had been set by someone who had brought the can to the area. A shovel and old pitchfork were nearby. He also spotted fresh tire tracks. Because of heavy fog and damp weather, the fire could have been burning as long as an hour before he arrived.
Huh.
Sheriff Royce Rhodes, Deputy Edward Davis Jr., and Game Warden Carl Willis met Brickhouse and were directed to the pit.
What's up, Brickhouse?
They recalled, you know they were singing that to him.
Yeah, you know they were, hey, we're going to go see Brickhouse. Who? Brickhouse. Okay.
They recalled their growing horror as they discovered more and more bodies. At the bottom of the jumble
more
of
bodies.
Smoldering torsos and limbs was a very little boy.
Wait, it was a pile of bodies?
Yeah.
The whole mound was bodies?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
The bodies of the two women and three boys could not be identified because of burns and lack of clues, and no missing persons had been reported in the area.
Plus, it was the 70s.
Yes. The remains were taken in funeral hearses to North Carolina Memorial Hospital for identification.
Oh, no. It's just to correct you real quick, it's pronounced North Cackalacka.
That's right. An eerie feeling settled over Columbia. Townsfolk that night refused to open their doors, even for a team of SBI agents called to check leads into the slayings. 15 of the state's top crime investigators converged on the wooded area the next day to search for clues. So the coroner says that they were impressed by the multiplicity of the blows on the victims. When you cave in somebody's head in one blow, why keep hitting them? The fact that there were so many bruises to the children struck me as odd. The older woman's injuries were less severe than the others. The victims, when alive, were in good health, he added. The experts could not identify the charred pajamas of the three boys or the street clothes of the two women, and their fingerprints were not on file.
So how many people total?
Five
people?
Mm-hmm. Slight head wounds were found on the women on the woman age 60. All the victims were white. All the bodies were soaked in gasoline, and two were slightly scorched by the fire. Authorities said the head of the two youngest boys was wrapped in towels, apparently in efforts to stop the bleeding. The dental work on all the victims was excellent. There were no signs of struggle, and there was no indication the victims had been tied up.
This makes me barf.
I know. So They theorize they took the that it took the killer more than an hour to dig the 4 foot deep bathtub sized grave.
Bathtub size. That's it.
He must have gotten there out there in a big hurry when the fire got going. He said they were just thrown into the hole. Officials believe the victims were killed late Monday or early Tuesday and driven to the secluded spot about half a mile from the nearest house. The killer apparently panicked and fled when the flames got out of control. So there was this massive investigation. They concentrated on the school systems from Maine to Florida to find missing persons. They were slow to establish the identities of the five bodies. Most of the victims had dental work, like root canals and cavity fillings and stuff.
Yeah. So that means they can trace it and figure it out?
Yeah.
Who did them?
They're going to try. So they several watches were also found on the victims, discounting robbery as a possible motive for the slayings, but providing possible leads. Huh. As the investigation entered its fourth day, no missing person reports in North Carolina or Tidewater, Virginia fitted the description of the slain.
And the fourth day was March 6th, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is when the Miracles took over the number one spot with Love Machine.
I'm just a love machine.
It starts off with a bass voice guy starting off like, "Hey, baby, you know what's going on? You're my love machine, yeah, baby."
Mm-hmm. So a torn price tag on a new shovel found next to the makeshift grave was a key to the identities of the five dead persons. So they took the shovel to the hardware store where it was purchased.
Yeah.
And the
did
guy...
Did you see any weirdos buying shovels?
Gave them the manufacturer's telephone number. The company traced the last three letters on the price tag to this other hardware store. So they took morgue photos of the victims to the Maryland store, but no one there could identify the victims. The store was selling 100 a month of similar shovels, and employees had no way of identifying the buyer.
100 shovels a month? What is this, a burial hardware store?
Something.
How many shovels are you going to sell in a month?
Then on Monday, March 8th, a resident of Carter Rock Springs, Maryland, phoned the police that her neighbors had not been seen for a week.
I haven't seen my neighbors in a while.
So this Detective Joe Sargent drove out to investigate.
Oh, Detective Joe Sargent. He sounds like a badass, too. His name is Joe Sargent?
Yep.
Wow, he's meant to be a police officer.
He spotted blood on the front door steps, and there was a lot more blood inside in a lower-level den leading to the master bedroom, trailing up a short flight of carpeted stairs, covering a hallway and on a bathroom door and in two bedrooms.
I'm not a sergeant. I'm not a detective, but this seems suspicious to me.
So the neighbors tentatively confirmed that the bodies were those of the missing neighbors.
Must be the neighbors.
The Washington Post broke the story on its front page the next day, March 9th.
Do we know who the neighbors are?
This I'm going to tell you right now.
Oh. The same day, you know, they broke this story the same night that the Adams Chronicles was on.
Okay.
It was a miniseries about John Adams and John Quincy Adams.
Oh, my God. You're kidding.
I know. I want to find it so bad.
I bet you do.
Meredith Baxter Burney's husband, David Burney, was in it.
Oh.
He played John Quincy Adams.
Well, there you go.
But competing with David Burney was Meredith Baxter Burney in her own show called Family on ABC.
Oh, Meredith, I remember Baxter, that show.
You do?
Family? Meredith, that was Christy McNichol, I think.
Christy McNichol, Meredith Baxter Burney were the daughters, yeah. I guess, on that show.
I didn't remember Meredith Baxter Burney being on it.
Yeah, the joys and... She wasn't Meredith Baxter Burney then. I think she was just Meredith Baxter.
Yeah, I remember
the
that
The joys
show.
And heartaches of the Lawrence family of Pasadena.
Mm-hmm.
Never heard of that show. Didn't know it existed. But it was on TV that night. And this was the night before Steve Bishop was born.
Oh, okay. So March 9th, five members of a Bethesda family, the wife, mother, and three sons of a missing State Department official, were beaten to death in their home last week and then driven to North Carolina where their bodies were set afire in an open grave.
A State Department official?
Yes. The victims were identified yesterday as members of the Bradford Bishop family, police said. The pajama-clad bodies of the sons were found in the fiery grave beneath their fully clothed mother and paternal grandmother.
So that's everybody, the whole family. That's mm-hmm. all the bodies.
Yep. Except for dad.
Dad's body's not there?
Nope.
What?
Mother, grandmother, and the kids.
So there's four bodies.
No, there's five. There's three kids.
Mother, grandmother, and the three kids. Oh, man.
So Montgomery County Police said last night, this is the newspaper report.
Montgomery, South Carolina?
Montgomery County.
In South Carolina?
I think so. The police said last night that the bloodstains were found in all four bedrooms of the Bishop home. Other bloodstains were found in the driveway, they said. Police found no weapons and there was no sign of a struggle in the home. Police believe the killings occurred about 6:30 p.m. Monday, March 1st, and that the bodies were carried out the front door. A station wagon resembling that of the Bishop's was seen near the gravesite at about 10 a.m. Tuesday, the Post reported.
Second.
William Bradford Bishop, Jr., 39, assistant chief of the Special Trade Activities Office of the State Department's Economic and Business Section, was listed as a missing person and was being sought for questioning.
Oh, he killed his family.
The Post reported that the search for the identity of the victims first focused on the Washington, D.C. area late the previous week when investigators in North Carolina traced the shovel to the hardware store. The second link came when Bishops were reported missing. A neighbor said Bishop left his office at the State Department downtown at 5:30 p.m. on Monday, March 1st, saying he was not feeling well and thought he might be coming down with the flu.
Or a little case of the murder my family tonight.
That's right. Friends said all the Bishops were active, including his mother, who frequently would jog down the drive to get the mail. Neighbors seemed to know less about Bishop than other members of the family, probably because he traveled a lot. But he was described as athletic and liking to play tennis and riding a motorcycle.
And murder people.
The Bishops moved to the neighborhood 2 years earlier when he was transferred back to the States after serving as deputy chief of the U.S. mission in Gaborone, Botswana, in southern Africa.
Botswana, y'all.
So the romance and the marriage seemed, from all outward appearances, was ideal. They were tall, handsome, intelligent California boy meets intelligent, beautiful, artistic California girl.
That's when you know you got trouble, when the romance seems ideal.
Yeah.
Nobody ever says our romance is ideal.
No, nobody. Well, no. Maybe some people do.
No, most people are like, that's definitely not ideal.
That's fucked up.
Those two.
That's fucked up.
Look at
up.
Those gross people.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're a lot.
Guy. Look at that guy's gut.
You're a lot.
What?
You're a lot.
I'm a lot.
You're a lot.
Well, maybe you're a lot.
So anyway, Bishop enlisted in the Army on August 7th, 1959.
Okay, back in the 50s.
The family traveled throughout Europe and Africa for Bishop's job.
Okay.
The slaying stunned Tyrol County. On Wednesday, March 10th...
Wait, what? What did you just say?
The slayings.
Oh, the slayings.
Slayings.
What?
Stunned the county.
The slayings stunned slayings. The county. I thought you said the slangs. I was like, what's a slang? No. Why did the slang...
Sorry.
Stun the county.
Sorry, I apologize.
That's okay. I just, you know, if you could just get better at articulating.
Okay.
Our marriage would go
I'll work on
better.
It.
Okay.
On Wednesday, March 10th.
Oh, now this, Wednesday, March 10th, 1976, is the day, not to confuse you with the last name Bishop, but at the same time this Bishop guy was on the loose and murdered his family, the greatest human I've ever met in my life, Steve Bishop, was born. And he's a friend of mine, a childhood friend of mine, my childhood best friend who wears a kilt now. Mm-hmm. And he has a Prince Albert.
Nobody needs to know that.
His wiener is pierced.
No, nobody needs to know
it. Nipple rings. And he's covered in tats. And he wears a kilt all the time. He was born this day.
I don't know if he gets infections from those things.
I know we could have him as a guest and ask him about Prince Albert. But he was born on Wednesday, March 10th, 1976.
Okay.
So maybe he's related.
So the Montgomery County, Maryland police examined evidence in Tyrol County and autopsy reports in Chapel Hill. A spokesman said Bishop was being sought through a nationwide alert sent out Monday night. On Friday, well, that's where the bodies were found, is in North Carolina.
Oh, Chapel Hill.
Yeah. Maryland is where they lived.
Oh, Maryland.
So he drove a long ways.
Drove all the way down North Carolina.
To dump them. Yeah. That's why it took him so long to identify.
Oh, on March 10th, you mean the same day that George Kennedy starred in The Blue Knight on CBS, the exploits of a Los Angeles beat cop named Bumper Morgan?
No, I have no idea.
Or the same night the Dumplings were on NBC? A fat married couple, Joe and Angela Dumpling, own a New York deli?
That sounds terrible.
Starring Geraldine Brooks and James Coco? Two fat guys. Two fat couple.
So they Maryland police obtained a murder warrant for Bishop, and Federal Bureau of Investigation simultaneously obtained a warrant for interstate flight. They had also learned that Bishop had withdrawn the few $100 in his bank account on March 1st.
Oh.
And his bloody fingerprints were in the bathroom of his Bethesda home.
Now, keep in mind, a couple $100 in the 70s is a lot more than it is today.
That's right. But he must have had money troubles, as that's all he had in his bank account.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a lot, but...
If he was a State Department employee, though, he should have been making more than that.
Making bank. Maybe his kids were, like, just... sucking up money left and right. Maybe they all had habits and ate a lot of Twinkies, or his wife smoked a lot of cigarettes.
So the next day, Montgomery County Police said a Bank AmeriCard belonging to Bradford Bishop was used on the same day the bodies were discovered to purchase tennis shoes in Jacksonville, North Carolina.
Huh, Jacksonville, North Carolina.
The confirmation placed Bishop about 125 miles south of the place where the bodies were found the same day. And they reported that about midnight, Wednesday the 3rd, a Wilmington, North Carolina waitress said a man fitting Bishop's description, who seemed to have been drinking, entered the Copper Kettle Pancake House, tipped her $2 before he was served, ate, insulted some blacks in the restaurant, and left after he tipped her another dollar.
Oh, my God. Man, I almost got away with this murder, but I had to insult these black people and eat some pancakes.
Oh, my God. Jeez. He said he had to get back on the road, she said. Police checked airport parking lots in Maryland, North Carolina, and Florida on the theory Bishop may have fled the country. He traveled overseas frequently and had a diplomatic passport, although it would not give him any special advantages in leaving the United States. By March 15th...
Oh, before that, before March 15th, meanwhile...
Oh, yeah.
During all this, the Four Seasons take over the number one spot. So Bishop is driving around insulting black people, eating pancakes, and on his radio in his car, the Four Seasons come on with... Oh, what a night.
Oh, late December back in 63. What a very special time for me.
So the usual lead singer of that band, did you know it was Frankie Valli?
Oh, really?
But he only sang the bridge sections. And if you listen to it, you can really tell it's Frankie Valli.
Okay.
And he sings the backing vocals in the bridge section. But the drummer, Gary Pulci, does the lead vocals for this.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's kind of weird.
Yeah, that's topsy-turvy a little bit.
And the bass player, the former lead singer of the Critters, sang the falsetto part.
Oh. Pretty interesting. Anything else?
Nothing important.
Okay, so by March 15th, a handwriting specialist in Maryland was examining the Bank AmeriCard receipt with Bishop's signature.
March 15th, they were looking at his signature the same night that On the Rocks was on, about a minimum security prison with four inmates and a friendly rivalry with their guards and a warden, starring Rick Hurst, Bobby Sandler, and Jose Perez.
I guess
so. The same night as Good Heavens, starring Carl Reiner.
So that day...
Where he's an angel.
Montgomery County Police
heaven.
Were sifting through a flood of reported nationwide sightings of Bradford Bishop.
Okay.
On the 17th, a news report stated that Bishop had been seen in Wilmington, North Carolina on March 9th, a week after the bodies were discovered.
Yep.
A man driving a maroon Chevrolet station wagon with Maryland tags bought gasoline in a new Hanover County gas station on the 11th, and a man matching Bishop's description was seen the same day in a tavern in Wilmington.
A maroon station wagon.
And speculation ran high that he may have stowed away on one of the 13 vessels leaving Wilmington March 2nd through the 10th, five of them bound for foreign ports.
So he stowed, they think he they went to a bunch of bars,
yeah,
got all hammered,
and then
probably
stowed
got
away
his wiener
on a,
out.
Went stowed away on a ship somewhere.
And stowed away on a barge.
By Thursday, March 18th,
Oh, you mean the night after the Bionic Woman was on the 17th.
Oh,
and
my
the night,
favorite.
The night that, you know who was starred in Bionic Woman?
Lindsay Wagner.
Yeah, Lindsay Wagner, y'all.
Hello.
She's the first female
cyborg. I had a
cyborg.
Bionic Woman Barbie doll.
Did you?
Oh, yeah.
But that was hot.
I loved her.
And then March 18th, but that same night, as Barney Miller was on.
Okay.
And this episode was called The Mole, and a burglar known as The Mole leads Harris and Wojo on a chase through the city's sewer system while Fish considers an operation.
So by that day, the FBI disclosed that Bishop had been under recent psychiatric care and must have a prescription drug to control his condition.
Uh-oh.
Flyers distributed nationwide by the FBI warned that he should be considered extremely dangerous and may have suicidal tendencies.
And if you see this guy, give him some of this Adderall.
Yeah, that's right.
Give him some of these pills. They will help him.
They calm him down. In Norfolk, probably police found the missing station wagon abandoned in the Great Smoky Mountain National
lithium.
Park. Are you listening?
Sorry, it was probably lithium.
All
Give
right.
him some of this lithium immediately and just force it down his throat. Now say that last thing.
In Norfolk, police found the missing station wagon abandoned in the Great Smoky Mountain National Park near Gatlinburg, Tennessee.
Oh, really? They found it?
Yep. His car contained a bloody blanket, axe, and shotgun.
Ugh,
also
gross.
Inside were bed clothing, dog biscuits, and two capsules of a depressant drug called Cirax, which Bishop had been taking.
There's the drug, Cirax.
Yep.
If I just had known it was Cirax.
The spare tire well was filled with blood.
Ew.
Time magazine ran a story with photos of Brad Bishop, son William, and the gravesite in its March 22nd issue. So it closed with speculation by some of Bishop's friends that he might have been a spy and he and his family could be victims of a rub out.
A rub out? because he was a spy.
Yeah, this,
so they're just killing him.
The same day, FBI announced it was searching for Bishop in the area around Spindale, North Carolina, near Gatlinburg.
Spindale.
And in Florida, where the FBI believed Bishop was. By Thursday, the dogs had turned up the man's scent in a visitor center on the outskirts of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. However, FBI agents in Knoxville, Tennessee, said the scent may be several weeks old.
Ugh.
On September 27th, I'm going to flash forward a little bit. Chuck Launter, a Baltimore FBI agent, said they found his car March 18th at a campsite deep in the Great Smoky Mountains, and that's been the end of his trail.
And we just wanted to watch Barney Miller, but instead we found his car.
There have been no positive developments, although we've interviewed several hundred people now, including friends, associates, and campers. There's been a lot of publicity on this, and we still get reports of sightings from people around the country, but nothing's checked out.
Huh.
So they couldn't figure out a motive.
I want to see
there was no evidence
like.
Of infidelity, financial problems, or job worries.
So just no reason why he would have done this.
Yeah.
It had to be, but you said it had to be financial.
I don't know. They tried to figure that out. The motive is very hazy. So if he was rational, the man had a 2-week head start on the police because they didn't connect the dots until 2 weeks after the bodies were dumped.
Yeah, so he had a...
So he could go anywhere around the world twice in that amount of time. The Washington Star...
Unless he was in a balloon.
It. The newspaper reported Bishop suffered from depression and insomnia and tried hypnosis and all of these things. The prevailing theory among investigators in 1977 was that Bishop left the car and began walking in the half-million-acre forest and wilderness. They felt he was somewhere in that great mountainous region, probably dead by then. In March 1978, authorities said they were no closer to developing a motive or finding Bishop. There was a sighting from the Netherlands, June 1978.
Really?
Yes. But they don't know. It didn't pan out. Like, there was nothing from that. So he's still missing.
What?
Yes.
They never found him?
Never found him. And there's three major theories that dominate the case. Bishop, known to be under psychiatric care and taking medication for depression and suicidal tendencies, killed his family, disposed of them, and then in a fit of remorse took his own life in some remote location, is one theory. Another theory is that he killed his family and, using his world travel background and fluency in several languages, escaped capture by fleeing the country. A third one is that he was the sixth victim of a murder plot against the family and his body was disposed of elsewhere.
Somewhere else to make it look like it was him.
Yes. So then on January 6, 1979... The Associated Press reported police believe the most plausible theory was that he carried out an elaborate plan to disappear. Some officers believed he planned his disappearance by having one or more phony passports prepared that will enable him to travel abroad.
I'll say he's a good-looking man.
You think?
Looks like Frank Helland.
Yeah, he does a little bit.
Rich's brother.
So they in March 1986, on the 10th anniversary, there was a telephone call the week before Montgomery County, Maryland police from a man who said he had spoken with Bishop in a southwestern state in the early 1980s.
Really?
The caller made the connection only after reading about Bishop shortly before.
Southwestern state?
Mm-hmm. So in April 1993, the Associated Press reported there was a cryptic letter from a bank robber serving a federal prison sentence, who suggested Bradford Bishop may once have considered hiring a contract killer to murder his family. Investigators interviewed people named in the letter who said the author was someone who could have arranged to find a shooter to do the killings. So he was in talking to this bank robber, and nobody really knew why or what it was about.
Yeah.
And they just had found that out after the fact. The letter may have affected the Bishop investigation had police found it in a timely fashion and interviewed its author. The letter was found in September 1992 in Bishop's file. It's the State Department. The sheriff said county police and the FBI visited Bishop's office the day the letter was postmarked and did not...
Bishop's office?
His office, and did not learn of its existence until 16 years later.
Wait. What office?
His office. He was a State Department official.
Oh, his office. In 92, they looked at his office?
No, they went there in 76, they didn't think to look through his stuff, so they didn't find out about its existence until 16 years later.
Oh, no, that sucks.
So The foregoing story was gleaned from newspaper accounts written as the events transpired, because Bankston, the author of the letter, died in 1983. As of 2010, authorities believe Bishop was living in Switzerland, Italy, or elsewhere in Europe, or possibly in California. In 2014, the body of an unidentified man resembling Bishop, who had been killed by a car while walking along an Alabama highway in 1981, was exhumed by the FBI.
Yeah, this body, that online you can see this guy.
Yeah.
And it looks just like him, but it's not him, right?
No, that's a body that was exhumed. It was not him, no.
It's not him, but it looks, if you look at it, it looks like him.
In 2014, at the request of the FBI, forensic artist Karen Taylor created an age progression sculpture to suggest Bishop's projected appearance at about age 77.
Yeah, that's what I've been staring at, is this sculpture.
Yeah, using Taylor's sculpture, several alternative images were created to show the addition of facial hair and glasses. And so that's pretty much everything we know about Bradford Bishop and who got away with murdering his family.
That's crazy.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a good one. This kind of stuff just mesmerizes me, because then I start thinking, I bet I've met that guy.
You met that guy.
I know that guy. I'm going to start accusing people that I see on the street of being that guy.
All right. So I think that wraps it up for us.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good episode.
In the can.
This is episode 44, I think.
Episode 44 is crazy.
Farty far. I think it's episode 44.
I think we're going to have school tomorrow, so I got to go to bed.
Yeah, hang on. Let me just make sure it's episode 44.
What are you doing?
Looking up our website to see what episode was our last one. Oh, episode 43.
This is episode 43?
This is episode 43.
All right.
Well, this has been episode 43. Thank you for listening. Editing done by Grover Cleveland Steamer. You have to give the credits. Music by Matt Truman Ego Trip, both the intro and the outro music. A lot of people love that music and they wonder where they can get it. Look up, just Google Matt Truman Ego Trip and find his albums, because I'm telling you what, every damn song is good.
That's right.
Every one of his songs is good. And I don't say that about anybody. I have a lot of friends who have bands that their songs are not so good.
Yeah.
I'll buy them and tell them, yeah, I like your music. Well, whatever. But Matt Truman, actually, I really like his music. It's really awesome. It just rocks.
So rate, review, subscribe.
Rate, review, subscribe.
Tell your friends.
Give us 5 stars. Send us money. We have a Patreon, which I guess you go there and you can just give us money. I don't know if that's how that works. We're supposed to give you like exclusive content on Patreon. Maybe we'll do that at some point. If somebody gives us money, we'll give you some.
We'll give you a peep show. We'll do some porn.
Yeah, we'll send you dick pics.
Yep, that's right. So, here, speaking of dick pics, here comes Chuck Berry.
Oh, here comes Chuck Berry again.
Get out of here, Chuck Berry.
American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. For more information, go to queencitypodcastnetwork.com.